So welcome to the next lecture on virtual machines. And this time, you've seen I had to fight with the TTT tool myself, as Franz Hassmann has retired, and so I'm left alone with all that technical gadgets. So last time it was Stefan who explained to you the translation of Prolog, so what Prolog is and how to translate it, and you have learned that the key operation, the key computational step in Prolog is unification. So that is whenever you you have essentially two things what you can do. Either you query another literal or you execute a unification step. So these were the only things which are possible in Prolog. And he also has explained to you that there's a runtime function, unify. And the corresponding operation. Now I'm a little bit confused. How do I kind of? Is it like that? No. I wonder. Maybe I. That's the problem. So that's kind of the thing which makes life a bit hard, because I need kind of a possibility to make to switch the slide. Is it here? Without keyboard. Ah. So without keyboard, it's possible double-clicking. So interesting. So here's then the next slide. And that this runtime function unify required some further runtime functions. And these were the runtime functions trail, backtrack, and check. Did he explain these other runtime functions as well? Or have you been there last time? He did not. So what's the point? The point is there are three things which can happen. Several things which can happen. But the main feature of the unify operation is that it may fail. So because two terms are required to be unifiable, which are not unifiable, like the atom A and the atom B. If such a thing happens, then somehow the runtime system must flag, oh, this choice of a clause was wrong, please try another. And the operation to choose another, if you like, another implementation of the same procedure, this operation is called backtracking. So that is backtracking, and that so this is a distinguishing feature of Prolog from, say, imperative programming languages, that you may have that Prolog is non-deterministic. So you choose one alternative, and later it may turn out that you did the wrong choice. Then you have to try another implementation of the same predicate, of the same procedure, and that is this backtracking. And that has another implication, namely, in the course of the choice which you have made, you introduced some bindings to variables. Now, if it later turns out that this choice was wrong, you have to unbind these variables. So this is a kind of rollback. So like in databases, where you have transactions, you have several steps to do, then you find out, oh, that is for some reasons this operation fails, then I also have to roll back. And so there's some kind of rollback. And in order to do this, to realize this rolling back properly, you have to know which variables have been affected during in the course of the execution. And that is in order to keep track of these bindings of variables, one has this, one needs kind of bookkeeping. This is by this trailing. For that, we have this auxiliary function trail. And then there's another auxiliary function. This is this occur check. Occur check is checks whether a situation may happen like this one, whether x is unified with f of x. Yeah. So this kind of situation is kind of not so good because there is no unifier. So there is no finite term which you may insert for x, and so that which you may insert for x, so that the two sides of this equality are the same. And now the algorithm, which he showed you for the unification algorithm, in this situation, if there's no occur check, would since it does not compute with terms, but with kind of implementations of terms by means of heap elements, in that case the runtime function unify may introduce cyclic terms, cyclic data structures, which is fine, but which may not represent the semantics of Prolog. And so therefore this situation must be kind of checked and then taken care of separately. And so there is this auxiliary function check which performs this occur check. So that is, it tests exactly for that situation which I have exemplified here. It checks whether a variable occurs inside a term. Now, since this is, if the terms are large, then you have to traverse the whole term in order to check whether the variable is there. And therefore this is, and if you have to do that at every step and very often, then this turns out to be a major source of inefficiency of the whole implementation of Prolog. And for that reason, this check can be switched off in many compilers by setting a flag. And so that is, in this case, this routine check is does nothing. So it simply returns true. So check means X does not occur in the right. So everything is okay. This means true. And false means here something bad happens. Okay? So this is, and now one must say, and that is kind of a little bit of a nuisance with Prolog, because if you have check on, if you do this check or you do not do this check, this is not a matter of efficiency. It is also, it affects the semantics, because some equalities which unify under the one semantics where you have cyclic terms and you have switched off the check may not unify with the other implementation, and so you may choose the runtime system may do different choices whether it is true or false, whether this checking is done or is omitted. So therefore this is a subtle point and should be handled with care. No, does it work? No. Maybe I have to switch it off and then... Ah, who? Now, there is... so are we happy with what we did? So clearly this implementation of... implementing the unification equation simply by building up the left-hand side and the right-hand side and then calling unify is nice, but it has also deficiencies. And the deficiency is the following. So this, for this right-hand side T, you build up elements in the heap which immediately become garbage or often become garbage. So if X is a variable, then the elements of T which you have built up, then it's fine. So then these will kind of move into referred to by the reference corresponding to the left-hand side X. But if X is also a term, then these two terms could be equal in size, and then all the elements which are constructed, which are built up on the right-hand side, are immediately garbage. And then one might think of, the practical experience shows that this garbage is a serious problem for Prolog. Prolog is notoriously storage intensive, memory intensive, and that means it consumes huge amounts of memory, which has later to be freed, and then the garbage later freeing puts stress onto the garbage collector, and so the introducing too much garbage kind of translates into a stress for the garbage collector, and that means extra runtime, which is wasted. And so, therefore, avoiding to build up, to create memory elements which become garbage is not only a matter of economy, of memory economy, but also a matter of decreasing runtime, because you decrease the garbage collection time. So then what is the idea, or what should be the idea? The idea clearly should be that we would not like to build up this T if we don't need it. Yeah, we would build up this T only if it is needed. Yeah. Okay, so then the idea is, so how can we do that? So the idea is that we, for the left-hand side, we do not know whether it is a term, but what we can do is, instead of building up T and then calling the runtime the runtime operation unify, we translate the nodes of T into instructions which perform the unification with these nodes. So if T is just the atom A, we translate it into an operation which unifies the unknown left-hand side with A. Okay? So that's the idea. No? Does it work? Whew. Was it now? I hope I don't go now in two slides at a time. This would be a bit. Did I? Yeah. What was the? But how can I go back? That's the question. Once again. I don't know how I can do a right click. No, this is just going one more. And that one? No. That's the. Then I kind of do the. I do. Yes. Okay, so I have to do this. This is a stupid way to do it, but at least it is a way. Okay, so that is, so here is then the new scheme to translate an unification literal, a unification goal, in that way that we put the reference for the left-hand side, depending. So put, this means you recall that was whether it is a, we distinguish the situation where the X is first, is the first occurrence of the variable or a later one, or whether it is an unknown, an anonymous variable, and then we produce the unification code for T. So that's, and now we have to say what is the unification code for T, and then we just consider the various cases what T could be, and try to invent something. So the first thing is, if I have an atom A, and then we have no possibility to do unification with A, so we provide an instruction for it. And then now we have, the next step will be to dream up what this how this instruction should be implemented. And the same thing is if it is a variable, a fresh variable. So what would we do then? Okay, so this is we make a unification with the fresh variable. And if it is an anonymous variable, okay, so if it's an anonymous variable, unification with an anonymous variable will immediately succeed, so nothing must be done. So therefore it is just pop. And now if it is a variable which has already been which is already initialized, then we do a unification, an uref, which should be the operation with a bound variable. And then there's only one case missing if you have a constructor application, and that I will explain. This is more complicated. This we will explain in a minute. So now let's see how that these things are done. So now I can try whether there was this other method. No, it doesn't work nicely. Okay, so unification with an atom. So assume that we have an unbound variable on top of the stack, and if it's an unbound variable, then this variable is bound to A. Okay? This is the situation. If we have an unbound variable on top of the stack, then we set, yeah, then we create a new atom in the heap, and that's, and now we record that we have bound a variable, and we indicate which variable it is. And the other good case is that on top of the stack we have a reference to an object A. And if that is the case, then everything is fine. Unification succeeds, and we simply pop the stack. Popping we do anyway. And the final case is that we have something else, and that would not unify. And in this case, then we call our favorite runtime function backtrack. So please, once more, note that this unification will necessarily pop the stack. So all effect produced by unification will be in creating bindings. And the other thing is, in that case here, when we see a pointer to a reference, we immediately know that this is a reference which this is an unbound variable. Why is it so? This is so because when we put a reference, so here we do it is maximally dereferenced before we do the when we put on top of the stack, and therefore it cannot be that the reference object points to something else. Okay, so now what happens if we unify with an unbound variable? In that case, no matter what we have, what is pointed to on top of the stack, we just bind the variable with relative address I, if we do u var I, so we bind this variable to that object. Yeah? So in that object, so for example, if this is also an unbound variable, then here would be an R with a self loop, and then this reference would also point to some unbound variable. Now, what is the instruction pop? Is the same pop instruction which we have seen in other virtual machines. It just pops the topmost element and from the stack. And more interesting is the uref instruction. So we have something on top of the stack. We have a variable which is not the first occurrence, so that it may possibly be point to something which is has already been initialized. So there is already kind of a heap data structure here. And so we have two heap data structures, and then we do not know what to do besides calling the runtime function unify. So we call this runtime function unify, and for the variable on top of the stack here, this one, and the maximally dereferenced thing, which has been the variable with relative address I points to, and that unification has been completed or has succeeded, we pop the stack. So clearly, recall this unify itself may fail, and in that case, this unify itself would call backtrack. And then whatever backtrack will do will happen, and perhaps also the stack will then be popped. But that is then all inside exception handling inside unify. MGU is the most general unifier. Okay, so now there's one case missing, and that was when we have a constructor application or a complicated term, like this one. So what should we do? So then clearly, we can construct instructions for every node, but what should these instructions do? And so the idea is...
One question. Is it so that you have a set of equations, and at compile time you calculate the most general MGU, and then you use the MGU equations?
What do you mean, I have a set of equations? I have only one equation, a unified query. But these are one after the other, and the unify function will first deal with the first one, then with the next one, and then with the next one, as they occur literally in the clause. So you do not have a joint procedure which unifies five equalities at a time, but you do one after the other.
Yeah.
So f of a x y. So if that is meant to, so it should unify. Otherwise, so it would not unify if f is different. If the term on the right hand side does not start with f, or has not a in the, would not match the a. So it should be f. For instead of the x, there could also be a variable. And then, for example, it could be like that. So what would then happen? Unification would find out, okay, both terms start with F, fine. Then this A should unify with the X. Okay, so therefore X should be A. And then you have X should also unify with Z. Therefore, yeah, X should also be Z, or differently, Z should also be A. And then you see here that Y should also unify with Z. From that you conclude that Y also should be A. In this particular case, it's not the case that always unification will result in ground terms all over the place. But some variables, sometimes it is so that one variable is bound to another variable, so that the most general unifier still contains variables. Well, the programmer, so in the way I have presented it to you, unification statements always are of the form one variable, so let us say T is equal to a term. So that is what programmers write. And if you want to have any, just this, why should I write? So writing down this equality is stupid, because F having the same, you must have the same constructor, otherwise you could directly see by just looking at it that it is fail. And only if the left hand, if one of the sides is a variable, only then something cannot be decided just by looking at the equality. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to have in our stylized, in our stylized Borlaug, it doesn't make sense to write something like that, because then I could also write X is equal to A, X should also be equal to Z, and Y should equal to Z, because these are the only non-trivial non-trivial equations which correspond to that one. And I do that, I would then write that in sequence. But if you have very pure Prolog, you would not even write these equalities, but it is all unification of terms in these literals. And I said, maybe I make one more point illustrate a little bit, to recall a little bit about Prolog. We kind of decided that in the head, in this, you have always only variables. And then you have to write something like here, x1 equals a, x2 equals b. But in real Prolog, you simply write this one. Yeah. And so by that, this is kind of, we have kind of factored out the terms which occur in the head of the clauses by writing them as such kind of equalities. This is our major source of these unification clauses. And it is a simplification, because then we clearly separate what is unification and what is the call. And in the real Prolog, and by some Prolog machines, if you do not do this syntactical simplification, you have whenever the call of a predicate or of a clause becomes much more involved, because this call has also to deal with this operational step of unification before you can call. And here we have separated it. So that was the point. But nonetheless, Prolog allows explicit unification. You can write such unification things into a Prolog program. Although you can simulate it in other ways also. But you can write things, and I guess I'm not sure, but you may check it, that you can write in Prolog even f of a equals f of x instead of x equals a. This is syntactically allowed in Prolog. I think it is syntactically allowed in Prolog, although it is a little bit redundant. Yeah? Does it clarify? And so then we also, since one of should be a variable and the other a term, and then I personally then decided that the variable is always on the left-hand side. I guess this is, as all these formats are possible, Prolog is liberal, so you can also put the term on the left-hand side and the variable on the right-hand side. Okay? Okay, so now let's see what we can do here. So we have this, the idea is that the code for this complex term, which can be very deep, very large, many variables, many constructors, that we kind of, we want to translate it into unification. And unification starts at the root and proceeds from, makes a, pre-order traversal over the tree. It first unifies the root and then descends to the subtrees. This is different from the building up the code, how we build up the heap representation of a term. This was, we first build up the leaves. Once we have to build up the successors of a node, then we build the node itself. Yeah, so that was kind of a bottom-up procedure. And now it is a, so it is, you could also, yeah, so it is a post-order thing. So first the successors, then the node. Okay. So that now we, so therefore it is kind of, also the code looks now differently since we do this pre-order thing. So pre-order means we first unify with the root. This is this U struct. And it is a constructed term, so therefore it's a struct. We have to provide the name. So this is this f of n. And then comes something additionally, which we have not yet seen before. We have need a continuation address. And this is, if you like, the negative continuation address. Because the unification at the root may fail. And then we have to do something. We need not continue with unification. We have to do something else. So therefore we need, so this A is the negative continuation address. Okay? If unification fails. But now, ignoring the failure case, let us see what happens if there is no failure. Then we proceed. And proceeding means, okay, so we first have to process the first son. So this proceed is done. So therefore, to descend to the first son, we have this a navigation instruction, if you like. This is this son one. That by that we go into to the first successor, and then comes the code for, I make it now in blue. So then the unification code for the first subtree, and so on. And then we have the code, and then we have navigation. We navigate to the nth son, and then we have the unification code for the nth subtree. And once we have done, we are done. Then we do something, something positive. So we have to do some work with the root still, and therefore we need an up operation. And then he comes the B. Up also has a label, but this label is kind of the negative continuation? That was stupid. No, this wasn't, it's not a negative, it is So there are two if it would fail, that was stupid. What I said was not completely right. So we have to consider three cases actually. The first case is that the unification fails. That is taken care by backtracking. So then we kind of, this is kind of throwing an exception. We do not have to deal with that here. So this is kind of inside the instruction. The next situation is that we unify, that unification succeeds, but it may succeed in two ways. Either we have on top of the stack is something which starts with F. Then we continue with unification. Or it is a variable. Then we do not need to continue with unification, but we have kind of to switch into a different mode. Namely into the node, now please materialize the given subtree. And this A is the reference, is the label where this materialization it takes place. Yeah? And this is down here in this red area. Now, and this B now, so this is, and what happens, so when I'm done with unification with a term, then this B is the positive continuation address. So what do I do after I'm done with a unification, and that is the first address after the code. So, now let us take one more look. Let us have one more precise look at this unification code. So this consists of three things, this building up code. So we have a variable on top of the stack, and now we have to materialize the term. But there is still one possibility which we have to check. There's a variable on top of the stack. We should build up a term, but this term may contain the variable. So this we have not yet checked, because there was no runtime function unify which we have called. So there is nothing. We have not checked that situation, and therefore this is we have to generate code for it. So this is this occur checking here. And I will explain that in a minute. And once, so if the unbound variable on top of the stack is not inside this term corresponding to the right hand side, then the check succeeds, and then we build up the term on the right hand side. Building up a term, this is something which we know how to do. This is this code A. So we do code A for the full tree. Yeah, for the full subtree F applied to T1 to TN. And then comes a new instruction. This is this one, bind. And this bind, so now we have a reference to a variable and above it a term, which we have built up. And then we do the binding and pop. This is there. So now let's once again take a closer look at this building block. So we have still two things to explain. I explained you the overall structure. I didn't say what this check does in detail. So check was called with a set of this is a macro which receives a set of variables and a bind and a relative and this row address environment, and then what does it do? So what is the problem? We have to find all the variables which potentially are occur, all the unbound variables occurring in that in the tree T. Now we know the tree T. Okay, so we look at it. So we see all the variables in it. Yeah, we see all the variables which are unbound. But these unbound variables, which are the first occurrences of that, they cannot be equal to the left-hand side. Yeah, because if they were equal to the left-hand side, the variables on the left-hand occurring, which is already on the stack, this is an variable which has been introduced earlier. So therefore this cannot be, so it must, variables which we are interested in are those which are already initialized inside T. So just an example, if you have f of a, and then there's an x which is fresh, and a y prime which has already occurred earlier. Then the only thing where the variable on top of the stack may occur in is in the term to which y possibly is bound. So therefore, in that case, we do not have to traverse f, we can discard x, we only have to look at, do this occur check for that variable on top of the stack and the y prime. And this is implemented by means of one such check is implemented by this instruction check. And if I have 20 variables, or here one variable, then it's only one check. If I have y and z bar and t bar t, then it is three variables for which I have to do the check. Okay. Yeah? So that is this thing. And let's see how it is implemented. So here is check. What check does. So on top of the stack, it expects the a pointer to an unbound variable. And here is in I points the relative address I relative to the frame pointer. In distance I, we have a reference to some term. And then we check whether what is on top of the stack is contained in that term. And that is, we do. Now, here we, since this term down there, the green bubble is the runtime term, we don't know what's inside, so we have to call the runtime function check, which we have seen, which we have already implemented for our unify function. And if this check fails, then we have to backtrack, otherwise we simply proceed. Okay, so this was this checking thing. Now comes this binding thing. So this was the other placeholder which we introduced into our code for implementing the building block. So we have built up successfully a term on top of the stack. Below we have this unbound variable. And now this unbound variable is meant to be bound to this newly created term. So this we do. So therefore, we introduce this binding, and these two cells are popped. Unified leaves no trace on the stack. Okay? And there's one more thing which we have to do. We have to kind of record the fact that we have bound a variable by calling this trail. So, okay, so that was... Yes, please.
Is there any particular reason why the reference thingy if uninitialized points to itself and not to something single or something?
I was just wondering. You mean unbound could also be done by being initialized to null?
Yeah,
or
why is it particularly pointing to itself? Is there any reason?
I would say this is a design choice which we have chosen here. You could also initialize it with null. I think there's no particular reason for that. So that gives, so since it is, in this way, we have a particular simple test whether it is unbound. If it were pointed to some other stupid thing like null, it would also be possible. Yeah, so there's no particular meaning, reason for that. So it's like when you implement partitions by doing this ancestor, you have an array where every node contains a pointer to its ancestor, and then what do you do with the root? You could write null, but you could also write a self loop. Perhaps it has by avoiding null and using such self loop, you get you may use zero as an address.
I thought about it, and it sounds like you save one address over the whole program because you don't.
So it's worthwhile. I don't know. So maybe it's not. One should check whether in Warren's abstract machine, whether they have it in this way, and so it's kind of inherited from other implementations, and nobody cared to implement it differently. So no, but that, so it, at least it's not important. It's not kind of mandatory. Okay. So now let's see. So now we have this building block to which we switch when we find when we detect an unbound variable on top of for the left hand side. When we found an unbound variable for the left-hand side, so that we have to build up the tree. Now we have to so with this kind of this piece of code we have already we have studied in all details. Now let us go to this one. So here we do this navigation thing, and at whenever we see a constructor, we have to do this. U construct f, whatever this might be. So now, so what would that be do? So we on top of the stack, we have a reference to some heap element, and we do now U struct fn. So we have to check what does it point to. If it points to an F, okay, so then we have to proceed. If it points to an unbound variable, okay, we have to jump to this B thing. And if it fails, then we fail. So this is the three choices, the three cases which we have to distinguish. So let us see. So here are the pictures for it. If we point to f comma n, a struct, then you note here, then we simply do nothing. We simply proceed. Why? We need not navigate to the sun directly, because for that we have an instruction. So we just do nothing. If we find this unbound variable, we do nothing but jump to A. So this was to the building block. And if it fails, then it fails. So by that we have, so in that sense, this instruction, U struct F N A, is surprisingly simple. No? So we only do something, we either jump or we do not, we just proceed, and otherwise we backtrack. The reason is in Prolog, when you have the same constructor with name F and you use it in unary and binary form, then these are two different constructors. So example, example F A. You can write FA and FAB. And then this F, and that F are considered distinct. So the arity is part of the name of a constructor. So this is different from functional languages, where a constructor has its arity and its type. So it has its type, and by that its arity. In Prolog, you have to provide the arity, otherwise it's not the same constructor. Okay? So therefore, this always this slash n. And this helps us, because for that we know it has n successors. Okay? So that is, so the use struct was amazingly simple. Everything, so now what is, now what remains to be explained is this sun 1 to sun n and this up. Now sun I, so before the instruction of sun I, we did this use struct. So that means we have a reference to something which is a struct. And now according to our memory layout, the successors to a struct are just stacked on top of the memory cell containing the name of the constructor, the RET, and the tag S. So we have here, on top of it, these the references, and if you want to access the ith successor, we add to the element on top of the stack. Yeah, we take what is on top of the stack, we add the I, and then we get the address of the ith, the reference to the ith successor. So then we do the h, then we get the reference to the ith successor, then we do this dereferencing to get hold of the successor itself, and that is that we push on top of the stack. So the pointer to the to F is still there, and we push on top of it the reference to the first to the ice sun, and that we have to keep in mind, because later when the sun is gone, we still have the ancestor, and then if we might get rid, we might want to get rid of it, that is this up, that will be the up. So, but once again, this sun I pushes on top of the reference to the father, the reference to the corresponding sun. So this means if you have a deep tree and you arrive at a leaf, you have stacked the references to all the ancestors of that node. Okay? So this is the sun I, and now this up, this then we are done with the sun, and we still have the reference to the father. We don't need it anymore. We pop it. Therefore, this up is a pop. And we have left it there deliberately in order to deal with the successors. But at the end of this code, then there should be no trace of the, no garbage, no remainder of from the right-hand side T, and therefore this up makes this garbage collection by popping and additionally jumps to this continuation address B. This is the first address after the unification code. Okay? That's it. And you see now it was this kind of, the small steps which we introduced all were extremely simple. This this use struct was a very simple instruction. This sun I was very simple. The up was very simple, and also this bind, all these things were very simple. Altogether, still the unification operation is very complicated. So now let's see. So now we have understood how this code generation scheme is built up. Now let's see how an example looks like. So here is one such term for which we might want to create unification code. So unification code, how would it look like? So we start with this at the root, use struct F3, A1 is the code of the building block. So where is A1? A1 is here. And so then comes, then I descend to the first sun. There I have to unify with G. And again, so there is another building block, namely the one for the subtree. So there is a building block for the whole, and there's a building block for the G. Yeah? The G subtree. So that's the inner building block starts here and ends here. And the outer building block starts here and ends here. So these are the two building blocks. And then the unification code for G, for the first subtree, G of X and Y. Then we again have to go down. So here we go down to the first son. We unify with X. X is not fresh, therefore a U ref 1. Then we proceed to the second son, which is fresh, and there's a U var 2. And why 1 and 2? Because X is the first variable and Y is the second one. And then we are done with that, and we do an up, and so the up is the positive is the continuation address where we proceed after unification with the subtree G of X and Y. So therefore, this is the first address after the building of the building block for this subtree, and therefore we jump over there. And likewise, now comes, so I ignore the building block here and proceed with the code at label B2. So then we have done the first son of X, of the successors of F. So then we proceed to the second son. So now comes an atom. For that we don't need this unification and navigation and building blocks. So therefore, there we have a combined instruction U atom A, which does all that all together. And then we immediately can go to the third son of the F, which is an unbound variable. So therefore, it is just so we proceed to the third son, unbound variable. Therefore, U var 3, because it's the third variable. And then we are done. We have an up operation, and we continue here at the first address after the building block, the corresponding building block, which is here. Okay, so that was all the unification. Now in between we have to switch to the we have to take care when we might switch to this to the building up, and that is the first building up is done here. That is for the G of X and Y. So there is one bound variable, the X, so that must be checked, therefore check 1, and then we build up the G X Y. This is U ref 1, U var 2, and then put struct G2, and then we bind. And slightly more complicated is here, because here we have to build up the whole tree, and again the whole tree only contains one non-fresh variable, the X. Therefore again check 1, and then we successively build up the term by putting put ref 1, put var 2, these are the successors of G, then we put G, and then we have the first subtree of F, then we put the atom A, we put the variable Z, and then we make the we do the F by put struct F3, and then this building up is done, and we bind. Please note that here we have a replication of code. I kind of remove everything now. And what is the replication? Because here we kind of generate instructions for creating this subtree. And here we generate instructions for putting the larger subtree. But the larger subtree contains the smaller tree. So this is a violation of our kind of unwritten principle that we would not provide would not translate the same code multiple times. So here we translate the same code multiple times. Actually, we translate everything here 3 times. So one is this for the unification. And then in this top-down thing, and then we do for the building would again be a duplication, but then the same subtree inside a larger subtree would kind of be would result in its own building block, and so there's a duplication. And in the worst case, if you have very deep trees, once so in the worst case somehow, if you have something like F, 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 and so on, if you have such a thing, then for every such F, you would have another building block which are all almost the same size, and if you sum all these blocks up, the sizes of all these blocks up, you get something which is quadratic. And that is not nice, because code explosion is something which we would try to avoid. On the other hand, and that is on the practical side, there are two ways out. There are two kind of solutions to it. The first solution is the simplest, do nothing. And why? Because Prolog programmers do not write deep terms into their code. Why? Because they perhaps do not like this deep nesting of brackets, and you have to count brackets and things like that. And it is kind of an unusual form of application. That is on the... this is what you always can say, programmers wouldn't do it. But then there is the point that clearly not always code is written by programmers. Sometimes code is generated from some tools, by some tools. And you never know what these tools do. They have no problem with generating arbitrarily deep terms. And then one would come into trouble with this kind of code generation. There is an alternative, and that is by kind of intertwining the building with the construction with the unification. That is more intricate and makes the code and the implementation of the instructions ugly. And therefore, I simply have kind of decided for this more verbose but clearer implementation. And it's also slightly more efficient if it works. Efficient at runtime, not at from the point of code space. Okay. Is there a question concerning these? Yes. Reuse. So that is, yes, you could have kind of one section, code section, where you build just the biggest term, the whole term, and then say, okay, now I have to build this up term, so I jump into a particular place, and then then I have to record somehow on my stack whether I am done or whether I should continue. And then that would need extra bookkeeping, but that is all, that would be possible. Yeah, that would be extra bookkeeping, and this bookkeeping makes the code also not so. It makes it more complicated and more complicated at runtime because you have to do more checks.
Way more functions
Yes, as soon as you have made a construction of like a put struct F, then you have to check, am I done or should I continue? Yeah. Okay, so that was now we have we had calls and we had unification. Now is let us proceed to the next larger unit of Prolog programs, and these are clauses. So, and then the next larger unit is several clauses can be put together to a predicate. But for the moment, just a single clause. And for a single clause, this is kind of, you may consider it as one implementation of a procedure. And that is, once again, the distinguishing feature of Prolog is that you may have several implementations of the same procedure, namely of the same predicate, and you try one implementation after the other. But in that sense, a clause can be considered as a procedure or as the implementation of a procedure, and we would kind of deal with a clause in the same way. That is, what do we do when we have a procedure, implement a procedure? We have to allocate some space for the locals. So that was the first thing what we did when a procedure is called. And then we have to evaluate the body. And when we are done with the body, then the procedure would pop its stack frame. So now, again, there is a slightly a weird situation that clearly we would like to pop the stack frame, but it will be often not possible. So there will be situations that we have reached the end of a procedure, but we are not allowed to pop the stack, and that we will discuss when we are at that point. But at least we will attempt to pop the stack. So here is the general form of how a clause looks like. So it has a head, and we kind of decided, or at least I decided for you, and you have. So as a simplification, that we have heads only contain distinct variables, and if you want to have something else, we need this insert unification goals at the beginning of the right-hand side. So therefore, the right-hand side then is just goals, a sequence of goals or queries, and these goals could be unification or unification goals or literals. Okay, and we kind of here, I kind of, for simplicity, I have given them the indices 1 to k. These are those of the head, and there are more variables occurring in that clause, and they kind of receive successive indices. So altogether, the locals are x1 to xm. And then if this is our set of local variables, the relative, the address environment for this clause is very simple, because the ith variable gets the ith index. And this is just the convention which I decided to use. Okay, so now let's translate. So at least I couldn't come up with something more complicated than that. If we translate a clause, we provide space for our locals. This is this push env m. You may imagine what that does. It would kind of increase the stack pointer a bit, and then you produce code for the executing the literals, and in the very end you try to pop the stack frame. This is this pop env instruction, and the minimal thing what the pop env instruction should do is to return to the caller, and that means to restore the stack frame, the frame pointer. Sorry, to restore the frame pointer. It would also try to kind of pop the stack frame if possible. If not possible, then it remains on top of the stack. But it at least restores the stack pointer, the frame pointer, and also, because we have to return the code now, the program execution must continue with the caller. So also we have to restore not only the frame pointer, but also the program counter. This is the positive continuation address. So everything was fine with executing this clause, and now we are at the end, and then we continue with our caller. Now the question, there's one, and I have tried to indicate that the stack frame is not necessarily possible to pop. But we may at least kind of keep in mind under which conditions we may pop the stack frame. When can we pop a stack frame? Well, You can throw away data, memory, if this memory is never accessed again. So this means you can pop this stack frame if you are sure that you will not return to it. Now it could be that we kind of executed this clause, and inside this clause we took a decision. And this means we proved one literal in one way. But it could also be proven in another way. So we have still a choice left. If we pop it, we do not have this choice. Yeah, so we have, if there's a choice left during the execution of the literals inside this clause, then we cannot pop. Okay, but we will study in detail later. So for the moment, we have just that scheme, and it is nice. So we can easily implement at least this push-env, we can easily implement. Here it is. Push-env means just set the stack pointer to frame pointer plus m. That's easy. And now I kind of spare you for the moment the pop-env, but what I can show you nonetheless is the code for a clause. Because that's very simple and very, in some sense, very intuitive. So the right hand side, we have to produce code for the right hand side. We count the variables. So there's a x, there's a y, and x1. These are three. So therefore, we have to do push-env 3 at the beginning. At the end, we have this pop-env, and in between, we have two blocks of code. The first one for the first literal and the second one for the second literal. And the first literal, so we have to, it's like a procedure call, so we have to mark a stack frame, and the A is the positive is the continuation address where to continue when we are done. And then we have to make the parameter passing, so we do this code A for the terms in the argument positions. So this is X, which is a later occurrence of X, and fresh, and for X1, which is fresh. So that gives us this putref 1 and putvar 3 for the first literal, and the putref 3 and the putref 2 for the second literal, and afterwards we have to do the respective calls. Yeah, so very simple. So that's in that sense, translation of clauses is easy. To understand what happens at the pop-env is not so easy, but that we will discuss in a minute. So now, before we do that, let us look at predicates. Now, what are predicates? Like constructors, you have to... The predicates are different if they have different number of variables, parameters. So therefore, again, you always have this slash k. So you have a predicate q slash k, and now this is defined by means of a sequence of clauses. So this here is the sequence of clauses. So I guess in real Prolog you may disperse the clauses of different predicates as you like, but in the end you have to extract the subsequence of clauses for the same, which share the same predicate in the head. Okay, so, and now what do you have to do? Well, so the translation, so once again, so all these clauses defining a predicate are the different alternatives how this predicate might be, how this procedure might be implemented. So there's multiple implementations, and the idea is we should try one after the other. So therefore, the code for the predicate should contain the code for all the clauses, and some extra information to do the navigation between them. So the first thing, the particular case where there a predicate is implemented by a single clause is notably simple. In that case, the code for the predicate is just the code for the clause. And we do it in such a way that we also give it a label. That is the only thing. And here is the label of this clause, because we have to jump to it. Yeah? And we use the predicate, the name of the predicate to as the start label of the code for the predicate. Okay, so now let us, so that was the kind of the boring case, but as a warm up, we are happy if we can do the boring cases. So now comes the interesting case, and that is when we have several clauses, and then we would start with the first alternative, and if it fails, we continue with the next alternative, and so on, until all alternatives are exhausted, and then we fail. Yeah, so that's the idea. And so we have to think about backtracking before we can try to understand how we implement multiple predicates with multiple alternatives. Okay, in which places is backtracking triggered? And it was triggered by the runtime function backtrack. So in some sense, this runtime function backtrack is something like throw of an exception. Throwing of an exception, and there must be kind of an exception handler for it. And now what happens at handling this failure exception? And as I said, we have to do a rollback of the computation. Now, how far do we have to roll back? We have to roll back to the dynamically latest goal where another clause can be chosen. So we could kind of think of that we have an exception handler at every predicate with multiple alternatives. So we install an exception handler there, and if we kind of and then we always will create new exception handlers whenever a new predicate is with multiple alternatives is called. So that is the idea. And this exception handler, and it is like if you should really think of these exceptions in Java or in C++. In C++, it's in Java. It is also so. It is when you throw an exception, this is handled by the dynamically latest exception handler first. It is not by any static something, but it is the dynamically latest. And that is the here in Prolog, this exception handler is called backtrack point. So that is the place where we have to continue, where we have to go back to, and all the bindings of variables which have been encountered during the course of program execution since the last backtrack point, they must be undone. All the bindings which have been done there must be undone. And in order to be able to do this undoing of variable bindings, we recall that we have recorded the variable bindings by means of this function trail. And so therefore now, in order to implement the backtracking, we have to understand what this trail does. And this trailing refers to a fresh data structure which we have not yet looked at, and that is a trail. So there is, besides the stack and the heap and the program counter, another data structure which is the trail. And this trail is maintained like a stack, So there's again a trail, there's a, if you like, a stack pointer for the trail, and this is called the trail pointer, which points to the topmost occupied trail cell. Yeah, and on that trail we expect the variables to sit, which have been bound. And so now, additionally, we add another pointer to our, so we have now the trail pointer, and now we create another pointer which is useful. This is this backtrack pointer. This is, if you think about it, if you wanted to implement Java, you would also kind of have need to keep track, where is my latest exception handler, and you would have to you would require a pointer to that, or store it somewhere in the stack frame, but you need an access to this latest exception handler, and this is this backtrack pointer which we maintain here, and we provide an extra variable for it. Okay, so this backtrack pointer points to a stack frame, so it is equal to the value of the stack of the frame pointer, either of the current stack frame, if the current stack frame has further alternatives open, or to an earlier stack frame which was which has been created earlier, which is deeper in the stack. This is this backtrack pointer. And so backtrack point. Now any backtrack point, so any stack frame can be a backtrack point, namely then when it corresponds to the call for a predicate where not all clauses have yet been tried. So if a predicate is defined by a single clause, then this predicate will never be a backtrack point. But if it is defined by two clauses, then you have you try the first clause, then the corresponding stack frame is marked as a backtrack point because there would be another alternative. Yeah, that would be a backtrack point. And now if for the same predicate you are done with the first clause, it has failed, and you are currently trying the second clause, then this predicate, the stack frame for this predicate is no longer a backtrack point because there is no open alternative. So you need not jump there, but you would jump to an earlier backtrack point. Okay, you understood this idea of a backtrack point? Okay, so that means now assume that you have a stack frame and this stack frame is a backtrack point, then what do you need now? What kind of information would we like to store there? So here is kind of the picture of what we could have in our, what kind of registers we might want to record in that stack frame. So let us do it in green, perhaps. So that information which we have in every stack frame encountered so far, this is the positive continuation address. That is the PC old of the other machines. This is the address where to continue after this call has succeeded. So this we stored in the C machine, this we stored also in the MAMA machine, and this was the topmost organizational memory cell. Yeah, so this is the PC old. Then the frame pointer of the caller, of our caller, this is the FP old. And then now the remaining four registers, the remaining four organizational cells, are reserved for the reserved for implementing the backtracking. So what else do we need? Okay, so this is two pieces of information. So this is the heap before the the current alternative has been tried. The trail pointer before the current alternative has been tried. And the old backtrack pointer, that is the backtrack, the latest backtrack pointer before. So because if the current backtrack, if this backtrack point has exhausted its alternatives, then there is a new, then there will be a new back, you need to know what is now the earlier backtrack point. So this is this BP old. And then there is this negative continuation address. So that is assume that the current alternative fails. Where is the code for the next alternative? And that is this. Yeah. Okay. So that the heap pointer is stored in the stack frame. The trail pointer is stored. The old backtrack pointer is stored, and the negative continuation address is stored inside the organizational cells of a prolog stack frame. Okay, and now accordingly, these have in this order they are put into the stack frame, and it's kind of difficult. So if it's more than three, we can't recall all that relative addresses. So here. So we may take the liberty to call them just to use the symbolic names to the left to refer to the values on the right. Yeah. Okay. So that is this. And now let us see. So this might be the last thing what we do today. So what we'll do if we call backtrack? If we call backtrack, then we have to, what here you see what we would have to do. We would have we have to return to the backtrack point. That is, we set the frame pointer to the backtrack pointer. We have to reset the heap pointer. We have to reset all the variables, to unbound all the variables which have been bound in between. This is this resetting here, which we have to not yet, which I have not yet explained to you, but which we will see tomorrow. And this uses the trail pointer and the old value of the trail pointer and the current value of the trail pointer, because in between are all the variables which have been trailed. Yeah, so therefore the TP old and the TP, these two pointers are valuable information, because this gives us access to all the things which have happened in between. So these variables will be reset. Then we can go on with the old trail point, with the old trail pointer, and we jump to the negative continuation address. So you see, in that sense, it is quite natural what the backtracking does, and it's not so complicated. Yeah, and the only things which are now open is to say what happens at the reset. And for the resetting, it also makes sense to understand what happens at the trailing. And these two things, trailing and resetting, these are the things which we will consider tomorrow. But for today, thank you for your attention, and I try to stop the recording now.